Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is...
Rosalind Morris.
And it's wonderful to see you. Sorry, say some more.
I was going to simply say that I am a professor of anthropology at Columbia University, also a filmmaker through my company, Rocam Productions, and I am currently based in Germany in a little town called Lüneburg as a senior fellow of the Leuphana Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture and Society.
Wow. There's a lot to unpack there, and I hope we manage to talk about the filmmaking, about the fellowship, and about your research. But to start off, I'd like to ask you, if I may, Prof, what's currently dynamizing, concerning, retarding, interesting you?
Well, Toby, I'm sure like a lot of people who speak on your podcast and generally with whom you converse, it's a very difficult time. I mean, what is most immediate on my horizon is the ongoing atrocious wars in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Ukraine, and the general sense of insecurity that people feel, both in relationship to this time of war and in terms of climate crises that offer the longer horizon. It's an anxious time. And one tries to keep working to make interventions that both speak to those issues, but that are not entirely determined by them, you know, to insist on spaces of freedom for thought and all the other things that sustain us. But it's a difficult time, I think, for me and for others. I am, of course, much less impacted than most people, certainly than those living in those zones.
And in a small town where you are now, just trying to control the podcat, Chinguri, he is a Pacific Basque militant, but sometimes he gets a bit jealous when I'm recording. And I tried to thwart this by feeding him beforehand. But anyway, being in a small German town, away from your normal job, away from your normal sites of research and filmmaking, what does it feel like to ponder these big geopolitical questions, as opposed to being in New York or being in Africa or being in Asia, for example?
Well, you know, there is a certain luxury that comes with being here and a certain sense of security and immunity. Lüneburg is about 45 minutes outside of Hamburg, so it's close to a major German city. And it is, of course, in a country that has been really transformed in recent years by the growing force of the far right, and where the historical relationship to Israel provides, you know, the context for strict limits on what one is supposed to say, on what one is supposed to discuss. And I say supposed to because although the law and indeed a lot of the activities of the state seem to be directed towards the curtailment, suppression, disavowal of criticisms of the war in Gaza and the West Bank, there is a great deal actually of critical thought and of insurrectionary speech and critical speech and speech in solidarity with Palestinians, speech that is, that both recognizes the historical experience of the oppression of Jews and the Holocaust here, but that takes distance from the use of that as a justification for what is currently happening. And Lüneburg is also a city that it's got a university, it's a long-standing entrepot city, so there are lots of people who move through here, and it has a much more cosmopolitan quality than one might expect from a otherwise very quaint medieval town on the Elbe, you know.
So do you find that it's easy to write, think, produce under those circumstances, as opposed to being in a big city or being in the field? Or does it hold you? Is it actually too easy and nice? And so you read novels and watch films on television.
I don't watch television here, but I do read novels. And of course, it's easier in some ways, not least because I'm not obliged to be, in the classroom or doing administrative labor, which has over the years taken a lot of my time. So there is the luxury of distance, there's the luxury of time, which is not to be underestimated. And but distance is also, critically enabling. And one tries to use that. I suppose it will be in retrospect that I decide was that used well or not, or maybe others will decide was that used well or not. Because I spend so much of my time shuttling between New York City and Johannesburg and those environments, there is a certain relief to being in a quieter milieu, I must say.
And speaking of Johannesburg, so one of the major places where you've done research and engaged in cultural production of various kinds is Southern Africa. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that, about life in Johannesburg, and perhaps also about time, something you just mentioned, because senses of time can vary a lot between cultures, between urban and rural ones, between cultures with different languages, and so on.
Gosh, that's an interesting question. Well, I have been spending time in Johannesburg every year since 1996, when I first visited South Africa. I had actually gone there with my partner to attend the opening of a conference, a major, I suppose, multi-institutional art installation. That coincided with the opening of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And at that time, most of my work and research was in Thailand, which I continue to write about and visit, but which I was in some ways taking some leave from. And I found in South Africa, such an extraordinarily creative, energetic, brave confrontation with itself and with its past, and a willingness to try to change that moved me deeply. And that really opened up what has been now almost 30 years of intermittent field research and other kinds of work. Of course, that world, like everywhere, has changed radically since then. And that nine in the late 90s, there was both incredible euphoria and great trepidation. And we can talk a little bit about the events and tendencies that have arisen since then. But the question of time, if we just to divert ourselves into that direction, because it's such an interesting question. It's interesting for several reasons, because where I work in and around the deep gold mines of South Africa is that area has been dominated by migrancy since the discovery of gold in the late 1880s. And people are constantly moving. They're moving in ways that are obstructed. They're moving in ways that are coerced. And that, life of movement, which doesn't, of course, describe everyone's lives. These are now, long-lived communities, entrenched and so forth. But, Southern Africa is a place of migrancy. So there is both a kind of anticipatory sense of haste and a sense of frustration, a sense of, revolutionary hopes not being realized, sense of disappointment. For myself, this is, the time in South Africa often feels like a kind of dilated time in which my experience of things that are not part of my everyday occupy every second. And I think maybe it's true in all decolonizing contexts that time is just frayed and multiple, and on one end has this sense of haste and pressure and desperation, and on the other, has this really profound sense of waiting, of deferral, of things taking too long. That's not a culturalist explanation. That's not a statement about, how people in different language traditions code or think of time. I work a lot with people who spend great deals of time underground. The sense of time there, of course, in that one could say eternal night, which is also, driven by the rhythms of work, has its dimensions, its intervals and intensities. But I suppose one would just have to acknowledge this multiplicity, which perhaps is not acknowledged in a lot of, let's say, lazier cultural theory that wants to counterpose a kind of rational linear time on one side in the, Euro-US world and that of often, African and other societies in which pastoral life or agricultural life was presumptively the dominant pastime and mode of living for most people.
I've enjoyed the difficulty of time with my Zoom recordings. And my experience has been that people in the global south understand pretty well the simple hour differences between themselves and Europe, where I am. It's very difficult to get British people who are 1 hour different to turn up at the time that's been agreed. Because, the invitation from me, as you know, gives Central European time, now summertime. And with US people, they just don't get it. It's amazing. So I've had to try to learn how to say, in ways that are not patronizing but clear to these people in the global north, this is what this means in terms of your time. This is what it means on the invitation. And it's still really complicated in many instances.
It's amazing how much people in the global north think that everyone is on their time. I participate in two extremely fine, what one I don't know, dispersed long distance seminars. One based in Johannesburg, out of the BITS Institute for Social and Economic Research, run by Isabel Hofmeyer and Sarah Nuttall, and one based in Basel, that is really a space for people thinking about Namibia. Run by Lorena Rizzo. And as you say, they have no trouble negotiating these dispersed audiences who participate from all over the world, from China, the US, and so forth. But yeah, in the global north, we generally experience everything as gravitating around the axis of us.
Well said. So, moving back to the mining issue and the time underground, perpetual night, this has obviously a deep connection to colonialism and to unequal development of South African peoples in particular. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the things that you've done with people in those mines and what you've learned from being there. Because one of the things you emphasize in your ethnographic work is that you see this as an opportunity to learn and an opportunity to share and spread learning.
Yeah, I think of ethnography, it's a formula that I have borrowed from Gayatri Spivak, to learn as the ethical drive and task of ethnography. And, the corollary of that is that one is not transforming everyone into the objects of one's own knowledge. When I started this work, I have a book coming out in late fall entitled Unstable Ground: The Lives, Deaths, and Afterlives of Gold in South Africa, which really tries to rethink the history of that industry and everything that it enabled, what it's done to people, what it's made them do. My work started really around, was focused on the functioning deep level mines. These are the deepest mines in the world. And as that industry has, well, declined as ores are mined out and as the payability of mining those ores with industrial techniques becomes less viable, I have become more and more concerned with life in their ruins, including the scavenging in the deep underground shafts that are closed but not sealed. And, there's lots to say about that history. Of course, a huge amount has been written. Southern African scholars, South African scholars in particular, starting in the 1970s, devoted an enormous amount of really important intellectual labor to understanding the role of that industry, not only in the operations of colonial governmentality and then apartheid, and the post-apartheid dispensation, but also in the formation of the world economy. In its enabling of the consolidation of British imperialism, in the operations of the gold standard, and in the era that we think or we speak of as being, post-gold standard, but which is still haunted by the phantasm of gold, and for reasons that we should talk about. This enormous book, it runs to about 800 pages. This enormous book is a rethinking of that history and an effort to go back to things that we thought we knew. For example, when people speak about the Anglo-Boer War in the early 19th century, which really was pivotal in the establishment of Britain's hegemony in the global stage. It's often thought that the dynamite monopoly played a huge role. And I've gone back to look at what the role of cyanide, hydrocyanidization, played actually in that struggle, not only because, one wants to debate what were the precipitating causes of that conflict, but also to understand all of the forces that continue to saturate the world. I mean, this enormously toxic process that enables extraction of gold at deep levels really is the hinge for that industry, and in that way, the hinge for an entire imperial logic. But also, I would say, and I try to make this argument, it becomes a principle by which the fetish of technology and the aesthetic principles of separation get hypostatized and thereby enabled to organize many other things, social processes and logics and dynamics, for example.
And you mentioned gold, and it's always fascinated me why it is so fascinating. What is the gold fetish, if you like?
What is the gold fetish? Gosh, I mean, it's been around for a long time, and of course, this led even people like Marx to assume that there was some inherent property in gold that made it the appropriate object, the inevitable object of attraction, investment. Its portability, its luster, its divisibility, and so forth. All of these physical properties are said to somehow drive this attraction. Farouk Stemmett, who's a Marxist economic historian, asks a very important question, not why those properties make gold attractive, but what was it about the world economy that needed those properties? And he makes a very convincing argument that's precisely long distance trade. The more global that exchange and trade relations become, the more that portability, the more that divisibility becomes important. And one can, and I think that's a correct analysis. That said, it is so invested with fantasy, so mythified, so inscribed in all the traditions that make it a value beyond itself, a value in excess, that this kind of economic explanation won't suffice. At present, informal mining of gold is probably one of the fastest sectors in all of Africa. And there's a reason for that, and it's not simply because this residual love of gold persists. It's also because more and more people are excluded from formal banking institutions, are denied creditability, don't have documents, are not recognized within the nations where they reside. And so the need for access to some kind of store of value, some liquid asset, some medium of exchange is incredibly powerful. And this is true not only in Africa, it's true in Central Asia, it's true in parts of China, it's true in Latin America, where vast numbers, hundreds of millions of people are ejected from what is an increasingly digitized global economy. So the demand for this gold persists, even where it's not actually feasible for industrial mining to take place.
And I think it's very, very valuable you mentioned the informal sector, because very often people in the global north romanticize the informal sector. It's not terribly romantic for vast numbers of people who are in it. For some, perhaps, but for many, not. And not being banked, to use that awful expression, has real costs. If you live in, for example, a country that's trying to get a decent welfare system going, that relies on your having a bank account, basically. You know, any kind of state assistance relies on that these days. And of course, when it comes to getting jobs in the formal sector, it's almost impossible to do so, minus computer technology. You can't even apply for things, right? So I think this is a tremendously important and valuable aspect that you raise. I guess the other thing that's, well, there are so many interesting things about Southern Africa, but one other precious metals world, I guess, or precious world, is diamonds. And it's somehow quite significant that Southern Africa should be such an important place for both gold and diamonds, but also for poverty and exploitation. And I guess there's something there too about the culture of mining. And at the corporate level, at the artisanal level, at the experiential level, I'm wondering if you've got any comments about that at all.
Oh my gosh, Toby, you've kind of that's such a fantastic knot of issues and questions. I maybe we'd start with this question of informality, which is often linked for complicated reasons, I think that are perhaps sometimes the symptom of confusion. It's often linked with other kind of notions that are positively valorized, things like, immaterial labor and a fantasy that digital life will somehow liberate us from drudgery, the investment in automaticity and so forth, from machine-assisted labor to artificial intelligence. And this is just not a good description of what happens in the global South, where we are talking about de-waging. Not necessarily de-skilling, I think, but just the expulsion of enormous numbers of people from employability and possible employment. In South Africa, for example, one ha now has official rates of unemployment of about 50% or so. In informal settlements that are dominated by undocumented migrants, that number skyrockets to 70-80%. And that produces dependencies, intense dependencies on those who have access to cash, either through pensions or state subsidies of one sort or another, or through wages. And you can imagine the distortions of social life that attend this level of dependency. There are parts of South Africa where one speaks of a dependency ratio of 1 to 25, which means 25 people depend on one person receiving a wage. So there's lots to say about this. This is no longer legible in terms of those old Marxist categories of reserve armies of labor that keep wages down, because nobody assumes that those people will enter into wage labor. And it is this terrible axiom of our time that if there's anything worse than being exploited by capital, it's not being exploited by capital in a context where there's not welfare state services and subsidies, or something like a universal wage, or these kinds of things. In South Africa, I've had a conversation over many years with those who work on informal mining elsewhere in the world, and I prefer not to use the term artisanal. And this is because this is a world structured by very deep level mining, 3-4 kilometers beneath the surface of the earth. Most artisanal mining takes place in relatively close to the surface. It works alluvial gold and so forth. So what one's, you know, what one's thinking about for artisanal miners in South Africa's deep abandoned gold mines has to be understood as taking place in the carcass, in the skeletal remains of industry. Everything about it is shaped by that. When people are sliding down shafts of 1,000 meters depth, or when they are in places that used to be dewatered or oxygenated and are no longer doing so, everything about their life is structured by this absence of industry. So it's not kind of a return, even though sometimes it looks on the surface, it's not a return to old artisanal methods. Yes, people use just buckets and spoons and shovels and have no electricity and so forth. But this is a post-industrial, de-industrial condition, not an artisanal one. And that marks a certain difference for at least that kind of informal mining that takes place in the gold sector. That's also done in the coal area and even in the diamond fields. And you raise this question of diamonds and gold. Yes, of course, it's referred to as the resource curse, isn't it? This is not because resources are a curse. This is because of the organization of capital, of monopoly capital, throughout the history of the industry. In South Africa, a lot of the money that enabled the early development of the finance houses that would operate the gold mines, and this was an industry financialized from the start, came from the diamond field. But a lot of that financial means actually originated in Europe, in England, in Germany in particular. And, in the late 90s, about 40% of the capitalization of the London Stock Exchange was in the gold, in the mineral sectors in South Africa. Unbelievable to think of that amount of investment. I'm losing a little track of your many, many questions, so maybe I'll throw it back to you and ask you for
Oh,
some
absolutely. I'm
guidance.
sorry. I was so caught up in what you were saying that I ended up asking the multi-pronged question, which is going counter to the first rule of conversation and interview, which is you ask somebody one thing, not 17,500. Well, I wanted to drift to one side on this, to one other angle, if I may, and that's to ask you about gender. Who are the miners? Who are the executives? Are they men? Are they women? Are they white? Are they black? Or are they South Asian? All those sorts of questions.
Right. Well, historically, the vast majority of the mine workers in South Africa and Southern Africa have been men, have been black from throughout the region. The colonial separatist and apartheid states organized ethnic difference as a principle in the mines. Mine workers came from what is now Mozambique, Lesotho, Malawi, Swaziland, Zimbabwe. Very strong presence of Mozambican mine workers in those mines until the really in, through the 90s. Quite early in the new under the new dispensation, mine work was open to women. And now, for example, about 12% of the workforce in the gold sector is female, not just above ground, but also below ground. It's a wonderful, actually extraordinary dissertation and some lovely articles by a remarkable young South African anthropologist, sociologist, Sanda Benya, who actually trained as a mine worker and recounts her experiences underground. But it remains a very masculinist space. And of course, the history of that industry is known for having been shaped by gender-specific migration. The hostels of the mines until the 80s were single-sex hostels. And it is often said that the, wreckage of social life in Southern Africa was precipitated in large part by the destruction of households in areas that were not close to the mines. I think it's a much more complicated story. First of all, those households weren't so integral and perfectly structured by companionate relations as this dream suggests. Although from the 80s on, it was a very powerful political claim made by the emergent National Union of Mine Workers and others that stabilization of domestic life would be a key to any effort to overcome the violences of colonialism and apartheid. What one saw emerging around what became very, very visible in 2012 with the massacre at Marikana, where striking mine workers were shot by police, security forces, and of a company, London Platinum Company. What one saw there was that mine workers who had gone on an unscheduled strike. Here's another question of time, the time of strike and protest. Mine workers who had gone on an unscheduled strike and who were opposed by management with support by the state were asking for what seemed like extravagant wage increases. At that time, they were calling for 1,250 rand. Was the call, and you can see that on all the placards of the time. It would have been a several hundred percent increase. And all strikes in South Africa start off with demands that nobody expects to be made. But a big driver of that need was the debt, the massive indebtedness of mine workers, many of whom were sustaining two households. One near the mines and one in the labor sending areas whence they came. So there hadn't been a stabilization in the form of restituting single households. There had been a kind of complicated process of multiplying and doubling households. And with that, huge indebtedness because the wages were not enough to sustain these many, many dependencies.
Prof, you mentioned in your earlier remarks that you had also spent many years doing research in Thailand. And this relates to the question about race and gender. So I'm wondering if you could reflect a bit for us, which you've done in your published work too, about your own subjectivity in these experiences with the other, if you like, or being the other.
Let's say one is always with others, and one is never sure whether the person you think is most familiar will turn out to harbor something that is monstrously other. On the other hand, one spends time with others who are coded historically within colonial discourse as the other, and one finds oneself recognized and recognizing in those people much. So I'm a little hesitant to embrace that concept of the other, and I'm enough of a psychoanalytically trained person to believe that we all kind of are inhabited by a big other from which we seek recognition and for which we find many, many substitutes in our lives. I mean, figures of authority and so forth, from teachers to parents to police, I suppose. But the real gist of your question, of course, is what it's like to move between these worlds that you don't grow up in, where you have to learn languages and with whom you can't assume that you know how to behave, how to respond, and so forth. Obviously, in some ways, Thailand and South Africa are universes apart. One at the center of British imperial projects, one ostensibly uncolonized, different languages, I mean, in every way so different. And my work in Thailand was concerned, very much a product of its time. It was concerned with the ways in which contemporary mass media intervene into and transform more traditional forms of mediation, ritual mediation, religious mediation. One could say that it was research on cultural politics, on the aesthetic dimensions of religious practice and so forth, and on the emergence of new kinds of subjectivity. I struggle sometimes to summarize what drove that research. Of course, I was much younger then, and everything had to be learned, and I made many, many mistakes, and I found the ease of being a woman alone in Thailand, to be born of, I could say my freedom was premised upon the relative lack of freedom that women there experienced. So I would say in some ways my entry into that world was structured by a deep misrecognition. I worked a lot in northern Thailand, which is a space within Thailand with its own language, its own histories, and which has been understood there as an object of internal colonialism, but which was absolutely mobilized by the nationalist project. Thailand's history in the 20th century was one of the resacralization of power, the resacralization of the monarchy, the destruction supported by the U.S., the destruction of the left, solidarity with the U.S. in its wars in Southeast Asia and so forth. Obviously, that destruction wasn't total, and there have been many, many forms of populist and democratic aspiration that have expressed themselves there. But in many ways, it felt to me like a history place moving in the opposite direction of what I saw in South Africa in the late 90s, where there was a very robust left, where the African National Congress and Communist Party could be, part of a coalition government, where redistribution seemed like a real goal and possibility. And as we know, that hasn't realized itself. South Africa has seen growing inequality, like the rest of the world. And Thailand has, of course, continued along its path as a deeply commodity-oriented consumerist culture in some ways. Capitalism lives there very happily. South Africa's struggle to resist all the forces of neoliberalism. And I would say, and I have said, that I think if there is a kind of structure of desire, political desire, that traverses these spaces, it would be the desire for equal access to inequality. People don't disavow the idea that some should be extremely wealthy and others should be impoverished, but they want to be among the wealthy. And this is, I think, as I would say, the structure of political desire that the global economy has disseminated everywhere, and that has made its way into the innermost recesses of the psyches of maybe most people in most parts of the world.
So this brings me to ask you about somebody whose name you've already invoked, Gayatri Spivak. You have edited several books in addition to authoring several, and one of those is to do with her work. I wonder if you could talk a bit about this question of subalternity.
Well, maybe that's a question to ask Gayatri, but I do think that the essay, originally written in 1983 and revised many times and appearing in many forms, Can the Subaltern Speak, is one of the absolutely necessary contributions to our thought of this time. What I think in the end becomes a kind of crucial dimension of that concept for me is the notion that subalternity is a condition in which the effort to be heard is constantly obstructed. It is not really a question of speaking in any straightforward, naive sense, literal sense. It is a question, not, it's not even a question of having a voice. It is a question of being heard to say what it is that one is attempting to say by power. And Spivak has at various times spoken of this as a capacity to enunciate, to access the state, to access other kinds of recognition. But this question of being heard is, I think, absolutely key, because as we know, there subalterns and everyone can speak vociferously and do. And in fact, and I've written about this, are increasingly concerned to be those who are seen to speak. So in forms of public protest, in the image sphere, in the mediascape, and so forth, to be seen to speak, to express oneself, this is easy. To be heard is not easy. And there arise from that understanding two questions. One is political and one is ethical. The political question has to do with the structures within which particularly minoritized speech is allowed to, is enabled to be granted the time and attention that will labor to understand it, respond to it. And the ethical corollary of that is the demand to listen. And this is something that I think is extremely important in the age of social media and our time of constant self-expression and diminishing attention to others.
Prof, I've got two more questions for you, if I may, Roz. And then I'd like to throw it to you to add anything you wish. Does that sound okay as a way of...
Absolutely.
Concluding? So the first one, you've mentioned the media a bit, and I've talked about your cultural production. This is voluminous in addition to all the, in inverted commas, scholarly or written and pedagogic work you do. I wonder if you could give us a little tour of filmmaking, libretti, you name it, and that other side to your work.
Oh, I'm very happy to do that, Toby. Yes, I do. I do write work in many media, in many forms, many genres. And at the base of all of that is a belief that it's not possible actually to find one way to enunciate or to intervene or to express anything. There are many idioms, many ways of reaching people, many ways of giving form to an idea. And on the other side, these forms offer one different ways of thinking, posing questions, addressing people, or constellating audiences. And so sometimes I write poetry. I have, as you say, written with Yvette Christianza, libretti for two operas. We can talk about those in a minute. And I spent a lot of time in recent years, I suppose in the last decade, making various kinds of documentary film. This includes a narrative documentary feature entitled We Are Zama Zama, which I made with some of the informal miners that we've talked about. That project started in 2015, and the film was released in 2021. And in that case, that was a very, for me, extraordinary experience. I should say first that I'm not trained as a filmmaker, although I, as a young person, went to film school briefly. And my general strategy was to surround myself with people who know how to do these things well. So I worked with a very minimal but extremely fine crew. Ibrahim Haji was my cinematographer, and Musa Khadebe was a sound recorder. That we did very guerrilla work, and we could talk about that later, but I wanted to work with those young people to make an intervention into the South African public sphere on one level. That was one of the motives. Because in that context, these young people who are called Zama Zamas, that word means to keep trying or to gamble, also means to resonate. So it's a word that comes out of isiZulu, but it's lexicalized across all the languages. They are reviled. They are presumed to be thefts of national value. They are feared and attributed all kinds of violent tendencies. And in fact, that world is highly differentiated and stratified, and those low-level scavengers are more likely to be the victims of violence and the perpetrators of it. But I wanted to help them make that intervention, to make a claim on the national imagination, and to show somehow, what drives them to this insane and dangerous and truly desperate way of making a living. Why would one do that? Where do you have to come from for that to seem like a good strategy? And I wanted also to, there was also an aesthetic motive. I wanted somehow to communicate, to show, to sound for dimensions of a world that I think are almost unimaginable, no matter how thickly described. So filmmaking allowed us to find a form. It allowed us to show something and also to hear something. We train I with Ibrahim Haji, my cinematographer, we trained these young men to use GoPro cameras, and they very quickly produced the language underground. They filmed for days, and they brought their footage back up, and we edited it together, and we tried to find a form that could achieve these two goals, aesthetic and political, I suppose. And everything about that process was a surprise to me. I had not grasped, what that life was like underground, when people stay for days, where they eat and sing and tell stories and sleep, and smoke dacha, and set explosives and assay rock and traverse terrifying crevices and so forth. That had not been expected. It also had been a mystery to me. The first time I heard this, the recordings, the linguistic world of that underground space was polyglot and constantly sliding between languages. There was an enormous amount of conversation, but people were listening to music all the time. Who would have thunk that the underground was full of music? People put playlists on their cell phones, which are useless as telephones, and listen to everything from Zimbabwean steel guitar, Maskandi and Kwela and Kwaito and all these things, but also Dolly Parton. And suddenly, this underground space that had seemed so enclosed appeared as the intersection point of all the global forces that pass through not only the economy, but popular culture and aesthetic.
And if I'm interrupting for a second. I'm going
Yeah.
to tell you, Prof. Roz, out of more than 500 episodes, this is the first one where Dolly Parton and Gayatri Spivak have been combined.
I believe that. I believe that. I could go on and on about that, and I don't want to do that, but I want to say that filmmaking became a means of learning. I mean, just bring this back to our earlier conversation. Much I hadn't thought to ask, much I hadn't imagined, became visible and audible to me, and became the basis for further conversations. And this is the nature of learning. You don't ask a question and stop there. The answer to the question is the opening to the conversation. I learned a great deal. I do not, in general, advocate the use of recording instruments in ethnographic field research. I believe that that gets in the way of the learning that you need to do before one can start recording, So this came very late in my anthropological life, this kind of work. I should also say that my own aesthetic ambitions were constantly in negotiation with those of the young miners, because I chose to make a film in which they could recognize themselves. I had thought when we started, we would never see a face because this is illegal activity, and I was anxious for them. And they refused that invitation to invisibility. They insisted on being seen, on being heard with their names, that it was their prerogative, their sovereign prerogative, to tell their own stories, and they would make the decision about the risks they would take. And so, what I thought was going to be a very abstract film full of close-ups of ears and eyelashes and thumbs and so forth became something else. Some of the more experimental, shorter works that I later made and that appeared in my installation that was at the Berlinale Expanded Forum returned to some of that more abstract work, but some of it remained a kind of fragmentary act or an act of fragmentary overhearing, which is a lot of how we learn and a lot of how we engage the mass-mediated world. As for the other kinds of work, the poetry and the libretti, I could just say briefly that what I like about poetry is the concentration of it and the capacity to use the gap, the absence of presence, the silences in language. And what I like about opera is precisely the multimedia dimension of that form that nonetheless allows language to become something more than explanation, where one is enabled to listen in a very intense way to language itself as well as to story. And maybe that's a good way to kind of close the arc, because I mean, these are all ways in which I've tried to learn to find a form in which that art and practice and ethics of listening can realize itself and then speak to others in ways that solicit some ongoing conversation, like this one.
So my last question before handing back to you, Prof, is a more mundane and boring one. I see you, amongst the many other elements of your practice, as something of an interlocutor, and in particular, an interlocutor between the social sciences and the humanities. I'm a big fan of the Annual Review of Anthropology, for example. This enables me to catch up on what wealthy people in wealthy countries think they know about the world.
Nicely
And
said.
you've done at least two essays that I'm fortunate to have read in that place. And I really am a fan of it. And I'm a fan of the Annual Review of Sociology for the same reason. And it seems to me that the interlocution you provide here is between, in one of these essays, Derrida and anthropology, and somehow or other you managed to do a Derrida erasure sign within those pages. I can't imagine how that was negotiated. And the other one that I've had the good fortune to read and learn from, about performativity. And I wanted to ask you about not so much those essays, people can find them, but more the task of interlocution between the very strong disciplinary heritage of anthropology, especially in the US, four fields and all that, and this element that you bring from things like comparative literature, literary theory, and all the critiques from those domains of anthropology over the last, I guess we would now say, 40 or 50 years. So it's a simple, another very simple question I've come up with.
Toby, your erudition always just amazes me. And this on top of all of your own just extraordinarily prodigious writing and then these great questions. It's what you say is really important to me, this movement between the humanities and the social sciences. I have become increasingly concerned with the desiccation of the humanities and with the kind of social science envy that often afflicts it. I suppose this function of interlocution, it's a very nice word that you use. I would hope to be worthy of that word. It grows out of what I love to read and what has marked me and changed me. And as a young undergraduate, I started off in pre-med, and ran screaming to philosophy and found I wasn't really, Karl Jaspers was too hard for me and somehow bloodless. And then I found myself equally attracted to literary study and anthropology. And anthropology at that moment it's a long time ago, seemed amenable to it could host both. And of course, I had not yet fully taken on the, the legacies, the epistemic violences of anthropology. You know, I was that became more visible later. But my own thought was changed by reading of Derrida, Blanchot, Nancy, Cixous, you know, continental thought, mostly its French forms. Heidegger never worked for me. But I don't know that I have a better answer than to say that this grows out of my own reading, but also my sense of what the humanities has to say to and with anthropology as the least scientific of the social sciences. I suppose the practice of reading, the way in which one learns to read as a student of literature, attending to idiomaticity, attending to the work of metaphor, thinking about language as something other than messaging, this is absolutely essential to anthropology. So on the side of my own formal, you know, training and discipline, I think without that training, it is a discipline bereft of nuance and vulnerable to extremely instrumental kinds of thought. On the side of literary criticism, I think, you know, what one needs to bear in mind, it's an old Kantian lesson, really, of the aporia between the empirical and the transcendental. You can't get from fiction to the world. You can't prove anything just because Joyce's timetable is perfect. So it's precisely the recognition of this gap where we live, where we all live, and of the techniques that one needs to use. I'm very devoted to empirical research. You know, there are times when sheer quantity is an important factor. When, you know, it matters that you get your history right. I think that commitment to a certain social scientific empiricism on one hand, and my really deep belief that one needs a literary approach to language, explains that linkage. And, you know, a lot of the new developments, new ontologies and so forth, new materialisms of many sorts, threaten, I think, in the name of a radical practice, to displace the recognition of language. And this strikes me as a really important question for my discipline in particular, anthropology, but others as well. A really important question for us to grapple with and think through, while we all embrace, or some of us embrace, the notion of multiple ontologies and so forth.
Even as lots and lots of areas in the humanities become more interested in ethnography, there's a certain envy of a kind you mentioned, I think, about that. So, Prof, thank you very much. I wonder if, in conclusion, there might be things that you wish to add. They could be aspects we've already touched on, where you want to say something more, or things that your humble interviewer has failed to query you about.
My humble interviewer has asked excellent questions, and you know, the problem with me, Toby, is that I could go on and on and on and on, and your audience will tire soon. I mean, I think this is a really, really crucial moment for thinking about the nature, place, function of universities in various contexts. And I think your podcast has a lot to offer to this moment, and makes a really necessary intervention in enabling these extended conversations, you know, in refusing the kind of soundbite that we are all tempted to engage in. But it seems to me that at this point, and I think both, you know, this is true in South Africa, it's true in Southeast Asia, it's true in the US, and probably in general in the global north, universities are under huge pressure. They are being asked to, you know, facilitate the processes of intensifying inequality by training the global elite. They are asked to transform the humanities into instrumental machines. And of course, they're under great political pressure. What can be said, by whom, when is everywhere a question. And I don't just mean the obvious dimensions in which we see state legislatures repressing speech on everything from sexuality and race to talk about Palestine. I also mean within our own disciplines, in which the regulation of speech has become such a crucial dimension of our self-critical undertakings. And it's interesting. I did a poetry reading recently with Yvette Christiansa, and our host was a great writer, memoirist, theorist, Katya Petrovskaya, born in Kiev, educated in Moscow. She's the author of Maybe Esther, translated from by Shelley Frisch from Vielleicht Esther, and some works on photography. And she asked us, thinking back on Soviet and Russian history, in which poets were banned because poetry was deemed so powerful, because the word was accorded such potency. She asked us if there was a relationship between the repression of speech and totalitarianism. I mean, is that what can make poetry seem so dangerous? I mean, who would ban poetry in the US? But it made me think, what is this tendency that ascribes such power to words? Part of me wants to embrace it and say, fantastic, yes, let us recognize this magical force that is always there, possibly for good, possibly for very bad purposes. But what is the relationship between that tendency and other totalitarian tendencies, which we think we're opposing, but which we may inadvertently be allowing to inhabit us? And these are questions, I think, that have to be rigorously posed within the university, along with questions about their grotesque financing. I read this week that it will now cost $100,000 a year to go to Vanderbilt University. And even public universities in the US cost $25,000 a year. In places like South Africa, this situation is even worse, where state funding for the humanities is really not only small but or inadequate, but diminishing. So we need to make a, I would say, we here now. What is this we? Now I embrace the world suddenly. I think we have to make a very strong defense of our universities, but also, take account of how much of the critique of the university from outside has come to inhabit us.
Beautifully put, a rather tragic, poetic way to end our conversation, Prof. Roz. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful and a privilege to speak with you.
It has been a total delight, and so lovely to join this excellent lineup that you have. Thank you for inviting me to join you, and for this very generous set of questions.